Hello again and welcome to another edition of the Culture File Weekly with me, Luke Clancy. And this week we're all like darkness and light and silence and sound as we process from a graveyard in Mitte where American artist James Turrell has been hacking the sunset to the sound worlds of Brandon LaBelle. And after a quick pause for refreshment at the Mudcat Cafe, we'll hear about some of the odd organs soloist Pavel Kahout has met on his travels. But first, it's Saturday night in Berlin. But not as we know it. In Mitte, there's a push to make Berliners pay more attention to their graveyards, which is why American light artist James Turrell won a commission to fill the tiny cemetery chapel with oozing, ever-changing light, providing an alternative evening out in the German capital, different from the dusk-to-dawn techno, but somehow quite like it. Hurry now, it's nearly sunset, and time to take the number 12 tram to meet one of the guardians of the light, art historian Liz Stumpf.
So right now we are at the Dorotheenstädtischer Cemetery, which is one of the most famous cemeteries in Berlin. There are people like Hegel or Fichte buried here, but also Bertolt Brecht, who lived right next door to the cemetery. And the houses, we still have the house here next to it, and there's a little museum inside. And it has the biggest number of graves of honors. And inside, James Turrell designed a light installation especially for this space.
We're standing outside here among the trees on some cobblestones, and we're looking into the church, and quite beautifully we can see the silhouettes of some people there, which actually have a strange kind of aura around them, because the light seems to split. The left-hand side of the silhouette is lit in red and the right-hand side in blue. And then inside there we have the church, which you've altered the structure to make the lights work the way they do.
When you enter the chapel, you walk towards the altar and the apse, which is curved, so it kind of looks infinite almost. You can't really tell where it ends. And on the left and right side, beside the benches, you have the what James Turrell calls fins. The light, the LED strips are inside these fins.
And the fins are made of, is it perspex? It's an opaque perspex?
It's also opaque glass. It's the same glass that he uses around the apse. It's this also really big glass element that was really difficult to install. He uses the same glass that's all opaque, which also creates an almost shadowless room, which was important for him because he said he wanted to create a space free of fear.
I went looking for shadows after that. It sounds like a challenge. Down beneath the benches, there are some shadows.
Yeah, they're barely visible, so we say almost shadowless place. But that's because of this special glass.
Okay, and now to James Turrell. Ich weiß immer ganz gerne, wie viele Turrell-Fans und Follower sind irgendwie mit dabei. Who is a real Turrell follower or fan who has seen some of his art? Und Sie? What have you seen?
Of I saw him at the Guggenheim in New York.
Okay.
And also in Los Angeles at the
LACMA.
My name is Gertrud Dalidov-Gock. I was the leader from the Foundation for Cemetery. I think I am self a fan from light, and if I am nervous or so, I sit down. I become still, and I like it. And so I am a fan, and I am süchtig.
Addicted. Yeah.
I'm addicted with this light. My eyes are looking for light. If I go through Berlin, and so my eyes also see, oh, there is a light, and I must look.
He's really interested in these shifts, and he has designed this installation especially for the sunsets here in Berlin. So he programmed the installation during sunset hours. So he was sitting partly outside, sometimes inside, and he really looked at the sky always and then looked inside the chapel and really precisely said like maybe 2% more red, and we could barely see a difference, but he really knew what he wanted.
There are lots of different settings. Do you have one that you enjoy?
I think the blue hour. I like the blue hour, but also I like white. This lady, I talk with her, her son died. And on Friday or Saturday, the service is in our chapel, and she want to see what light shall I take. And I present her the four white colors, and I think she takes number one, amber.
What is James Turrell's religious position? I think he began as a Quaker.
Yeah, exactly. He is a Quaker, and he has a very special relation to light. For him, light really is inherent in every person. He says that his grandmother took him to Quaker meeting places where you sit in silence and you go inside to greet the light. And that really touched him, and he says that in his work there's always this this moment where the inner and the outer light meet. And here we also have the light coming in through the windows from the sunset that's meeting the light inside, the artificial light from the light installation. And there's this special connection where we then have this optical illusion, which is very special.
Everything has just gone blue around us.
Yes. I think this was always a really popular cemetery in Berlin. We have lots of tourist group coming here every day. But I think, of course, it has changed the cemetery in a certain way. There are always people who are really curious. They just come here to have a look at the graves, but then they notice the light and they stand outside, like we have a visitor right now doing the exact same thing, actually.
Who's making a magnificent silhouette against the really bright light that comes out of the darkness.
Yeah, and for me it's always fascinating to just watch that. People can really stand here for almost 20 minutes in silence, and they are drawn to the light. Also, we have the cemetery cafe that we just opened up a few months ago, and I think the cemetery is really becoming more lively now. Yeah, I know that sounds funny, but that's also something that in Berlin is quite fashionable, actually. Berlin actually has quite a lot of cemeteries. We have over 200 cemeteries in the city. There's so much about the history of Berlin that is told in these places, histories that are kind of hidden here.
Eben auch Patenschaften, wenn ich das kann ich auf Englisch nicht. We have people who bought a grave, an old grave. They pay for the restoration, and when they died, they can be buried there. And so the old graves are restored.
So they kind of adopt a grave. So they pay for the restoration, but then they can be buried in these big old beautiful graves. Which is very important for the cemeteries, because of course they don't have enough money to restore all the graves, and in many cases the families are not alive anymore, or they don't look after the grave, and they're very art historically important graves. And so for Berlin we have this program that is really important, where local people can adopt these graves.
So if I chose, could I be buried in Herbert Marcuse's grave then?
That's an Urnengrab.
It's not a big grave, so it's like for a small urn. So if you want to...
Only for one person. Yeah. And after 20 years, you can take this grave.
Are we making a deal now?
Yeah, because here you only have a grave for 20 years, and then you have to pay again. Yes. Or you're kind of being, not thrown out, but... So if you're a famous person, probably also Marcuse, then your grave is being paid for by the city of Berlin, by the Senate.
Until the Senate says it's enough.
Yeah, sometimes the Senate says, oh, maybe the person is not that important for Berlin anymore, so we stop paying for it. So
that could be a terrible moment in your own history, couldn't it? The government has just decided that you're not that interesting anymore.
Yeah, exactly. I'm not paying for your grave anymore. But I think some people like Hegel or Bertolt Brecht, I think they're pretty on the safe side.
sunset at the Dora Tiana Stadischer Friedhof Berlin. Check out at Culturefile Pod for the snaps and for all our general digital AOBs. Now, who's there listening with you right now? Not just the person in the back seat or even the one riding shotgun. What about all the strangers out there, scattered around the island, listening to this sound? All of us listening now, are we in reality all in the same place, together? A recent conference at DIT on space and sound brought to Ireland one of the world's most fascinating theorists on sound, Brandon LaBelle. LaBelle is a sound artist and writer who explores sound and how it builds the world we know and how it offers the space to think of new ones. LaBelle spoke to the conference about what he called minor acoustics and how they may help us to approach the unknown, after which he was approached by Culturefile's Sharon Phelan.
I'm Brandon LaBelle, and I'm here as an artist and researcher, working quite a bit with sound. And so I guess in my own practice, I'm both working in installation and exhibition formats, as well as performance. And I guess in my academic work, researching different aspects of sound and what it means to listen, and maybe also what a kind of sonic culture can offer different kinds of contexts and different kinds of questions. One of the things that I've been concerned with is to try to think about practices of sound and also the experiences generally we have of sound and listening, and try to think what do they contribute or how might they contribute to certain social and political realities today. That maybe in fact this acoustic space, this practices of listening are very essential in a way to how we might negotiate and deal with crises. This is one of the beautiful things about radio also, is the relationship to the stranger. So I always think that radio is a constructs a community of strangers. We have a feeling that there is a collective body out there listening, but they don't know each other and we don't know them. So this is maybe also a little bit what comes out, or what I try to also concentrate on, is this relationship between the concrete and the ephemeral. I started to think, what kind of relationships does it produce then if we enter this acoustic space as listeners? Then what kind of relationship is that? You know, how do we start to describe this community that acoustic space produces? So the stranger became a motif or a vehicle for trying to get at that description. So I drew upon different theoretical works. For instance, Michael Warner talks about what he calls stranger sociability, and he basically just tries to describe how the stranger is operating as a slightly invisible but very present character in public formations, in, for instance, the space of assembly. Publics are always somehow full of strangers that slip in and out of being familiar and unfamiliar. We come together with others, and there's always the feeling that there is some figure there that is not yet known, and in a way are all responding to the possibility of the stranger by trying to reach out, by trying to address the ones that we do not know. So I really like this as an image, and thought, yes, maybe that starts to suggest relationships, a sociability, a collective body that is not always about the known, but actually always contains the unknown, the unfamiliar, the strange. And I thought maybe this is really something that sound is doing, or acoustic space is constituted by this stranger sociability. the feeling that what I hear, I may not fully understand, and actually I may never really know exactly where it's coming from, or from what body does it arise. And I thought that's also very exciting in terms of trying to rethink how we understand publics or sociability or collective productions or frameworks. So maybe it's through listening that we start to encounter others in another way. If we understand acoustics as a space of power, as a dynamic of power, again going back to what is heard, what is allowed to be heard, and what is unheard, this is a kind of power relationship that is a kind of acoustic power construct, and that minor acoustics is that very thing that tries to counter or unsettle that power relation by introducing another type of tone, maybe, or smuggling in a kind of noise, or giving way to a voice of the other that we do not understand. So I sort of feel like sound art, as a range of practices, engages with this relationality and intensifies it. So in different ways, by bringing us close to things that are very distant usually, or things again that are unrecognizable, or for instance, I tried to talk through the work of Jana Vinderen, who is an artist doing a lot of field recording with underwater recordings, kind of hydrophone recordings, and this feeling of actually what she collects, maybe she identifies some of it, but generally speaking, it's full of bodies and creatures and sounds that in a way are always a little bit outside of recognizability. You can't really identify. And yet, at the same time, we sort of listen to it and get close to it and enter into some kind of relationship with this unknown.
Sound artist Brandon LaBelle at DIT's Sounding Out the Space conference. Sharon Thielen was the reporter. And next, why do you always end up down at the Mudcat Cafe? Really? Well, it must have been somebody who looked just like you. In any case, Lucy Wright was certainly there. Wright's a researcher in traditional music at the University of Sheffield, and she's part of the Digital Folk Project that looks at what an oral tradition really means in this 21st century of live, global listening and learning.
The Digital Folk Project is looking at the diverse ways that contemporary folk arts participants are making use of digital technologies to learn new materials, to reinterpret traditional tunes and songs, to communicate with other folk arts participants, and just the way that that kind of digital technology affordance is affecting the tradition. It's very, very difficult now to imagine the world of folk and traditional music without the ubiquity of digital resources. We almost don't know that we're using them anymore. It's so common to learn a tune from YouTube or to look something up on Google now that actually it's almost not a conscious practice.
The question is that all of these technologies flavour but also facilitate at some level, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the things that we're thinking about is to do with this idea of transmission and the ways that that people are making use of a whole range of online platforms and resources, particularly for learning new materials and communicating with other people. But the ways that they're kind of reconciling that with this idea of an oral tradition. And obviously the oral tradition is kind of central kind of premise for folk music. And it's often sort of seen as pretty much constitutive of folk music, and that learning by ear. These are all things that are really highly valued. And yet so much of learning now is taking place online. You know, it's not happening face-to-face, or it's happening in sort of mediated ways and quite differently.
There already is some kind of uncertainty about the idea of the oral tradition to begin with. I mean, that's not unproblematic either.
Oh, absolutely not. No, I mean, we're not trying to say for a second that that folks should necessarily be seen as the product of an oral tradition. Obviously, the influence of print media can't be, you know, overlooked. And also, you know, the recordings. This is obviously something that's an ongoing thing that's been happening for many years. And digital technology is just the newest, you know, in a line of technologies of that kind.
I want to tell you all about the way they treated me.
We were talking about different resources that are quite popular at the moment, well, and have been for a while, with folk arts participants. The first we were talking about was the Mudcat Cafe online discussion forum. And this is one of the largest, I would say, online discussion boards. It also has a really comprehensive database of songs and tunes. And I think they said that there's 100,000 posts on this, 100,000 threads on this, and 4 million individual messages. So it's pretty big. It was created in 1996 by a philosophy grad from Philadelphia called Max Spiegel. It began as a static website. It was something that he just set up basically to explore his interest in the World Wide Web as a kind of emergent space, but also to celebrate his love of blues music. So he was doing a lot of research at the time in physical archives, so travelling around the country to the Library of Congress and all over, finding, you know, information about blues music, and then he wanted to share that with other people online. But it quite quickly changed from that kind of static site to being something more interactive. He collaborated with a guy called Dick Greenhouse, who had a database called the Digital Tradition, and that was hosted in Palo Alto. And it was one of the first kind of digitization projects of folk music and song. Dick had been going around a lot of kind of festivals and events collecting songs from singers and had made those available. Once they were made available online, some of the publishing companies got in touch about copyright infringement issues. Sadly, it was removed, and Max managed to make that available, you know, again by hosting it in his own house.
But the copyright problem didn't go away.
No, absolutely not. As far as I gather, this is an ongoing issue for Max. He still hosts Mudcat in his own house and has always kind of joked that, you know, if it really comes to it, he would just pack it in his trunk and go off to Iceland or something. He's really committed to this idea of maintaining these things as available to everybody and not kowtowing to the copyright laws.
The other thing you looked at was the question of notation. You looked at ABC notation.
ABC notation is a form of recording and annotating musical, you know, music tunes, which was created by a guy called Chris Walshaw, again in the mid-1990s. And he was somebody who wasn't familiar with Western stave notation and wanted to find a way to really quickly and easily record the tunes that he was hearing in sessions so that he'd remember them when he got home. Being someone with quite an expertise in you know, web and internet technologies, he created this system for recording tunes so that you would have the letter name of the note and then a number which would say how long that note should be played for. And this was also really easy to send, you know, in the early days of the internet and the early days of email, when you couldn't send a picture of a musical score, you could send just, you know, a series of numbers and letters. And this was picked up quite quickly. It's really popular now, and you know, certainly in the Celtic music sphere, it seems to be a really much used system, to the extent that my colleague was speaking to somebody at a folk festival in Sidmouth, a young guy who played the banjo, and he was saying that he'd learned almost exclusively by ABC notation. But he was amazed to find out that the person who invented ABC was still alive, because for him, he imagined it to be actually the precursor to stave notation. It seemed to be something more kind of earthy and authentic, perhaps, than that dot notation.
The Perils of Authenticity, Lucy Wright there of the Digital Folk Project. And finally, Czech organist Pavel Kohout, who made his debut on the instrument at Christchurch Cathedral, Dublin recently, where Áine Gallagher joined him to talk about life in the loft and about how organ music is being made and remade in the 21st century.
They're huge instruments, so It's not the kind of instrument that you mess about, you know, on an evening at home.
Some wealthy people, they own also pipe organs at the home.
Really?
Yeah, I played several private concerts also for this kind of people in Australia, America. So it was historically also quite common to have a little house organ. Music lovers, and they play very on a very basic level or organ, but with nowadays technique, you can even record with these MIDI systems some organist playing on your organ. So you later push a button and the organ plays very well from that Prafi organist for yourself. Like, it's a kind of high stuff playback, would say. For example, in the Melbourne Town Hall in Australia, they have this system as well, and they push a button and the organs play itself.
No practice necessary.
And Japan is also very Europe-oriented in the last times, and they love also pipe organ to have like a European-style wedding. And of course they need some organ, but that can be a problem, you know, to move people in the city. So sometimes the very nice hotels, they build the chapel with organ. So once I was invited to play also a concert in a hotel chapel with instrument, but it's a sometimes very interesting mix of pipes and digital, but in a very good way. So you have all the comfort of a beautiful hotel and you play organ as well.
Best of both worlds.
Travelling organist Pavel Kahout there talking to Anya Gallagher, and that brings to an end this edition of the Culture File Weekly. There'll be more of The Different next week at 7 p.m, but day and night for the foreseeable future, all episodes of Culture File in its weekly and daily forms are available to stream and podcast via a myriad of locations that are both everywhere and nowhere. Suffice to say, the Culture File page on the Lyric site has the skinny. Bye now.